KQRIW here. Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. You'll also hear John, KC2WGV. John and Dick attempt to organize this enthusiastic crowd that meets most Sunday evenings to discuss our favorite subject, ham radio. We hope it's educational. That's our main purpose. There's a lot to learn about these wireless products and all of the components that go into them. So we try very hard to be educational. As you've heard me, John and I say quite often, no question is too dumb to be asked, answered. So don't worry about the fact you think you've got a dumb question. Periodically, you'll hear some what you think are very highfalutin subjects being discussed. And sometimes we discuss Ohm's law, you know what I mean? Or what is a resistor, and how do you make one, how do you homebrew one? So cabbages and kings are what we sometimes discuss, but that's kind of a range of dynamic range of technology, so to speak. Crystal detectors, crystal radios, all the way up to software-defined radios with fancy computer techniques. A person signs into the technical mech by giving John and take your call letters, your name, and the word yes. You're going to be doing that in a minute or so. There was a great big flea market today in Levittown. It's the Levittown Hall, run by the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, so quite a few people went there, even though the bad weather was predicted for this weekend. Quite a few people went there and found some bargains. In fact, I remember hearing somebody on with the new Walks-On radio that he bought at the flea market. It sounded extremely good. A buddy of mine bought some good things that I was interested in and passed them on to me. I didn't get a chance to go. Because of the crazy weather we're having this weekend, I'm not sure quite how the technet's going to run. We'll run it a little bit more loosely than normal. In other words, if somebody has subjects that they think are appropriate to be discussing as far as the weather is concerned, certainly bring that up. I'd like to, anybody that wants to give a testimonial as to how good the flea markets were you. You know, was it big enough, small enough? Did it have enough vendors? Was the price right? You know what I mean? When it comes to my particular location, in the old days, used to get water in my basement because the topography of my property is such that the thousands of gallons of water running down the street used to pour onto my property, create a great big lake in the front yard, and then eventually put quite a bit of water in my basement. And I've since created berms and water bypassing techniques and make sure that the gutters are well cleaned out so that the water being collected by the roof is directed in the right purposes, the right places. So, maybe you guys will have to do something similar, tie down things that you think are going to get blown around this weekend. So it gives you a little bit of an idea of some of the subjects that we might be discussing tonight. We'll play it by ear. So give me a call letters and name right now if you have a question or a comment for the net. KQRIW listening.
W-H-O-R-Y.
Go.
Yes, this is Joe.
Okay, we had a double that time. Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, we got that, Joe. Who was the second Joe? Please give me your call letters and name, sir. I got your name, Joe, but what were your call letters, sir?
Yes, this is the second Joe, KC2YWQ, Yankee Whiskey, yes.
Okay, Quebec Yankee Whiskey, KC2, we got Joe number two. All right, we got Joe and Joe. Anyone else want to check in with call letters or name? Call letters and name, give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW.
Thank you, Mike Bravo, and I want to come back a little later and give a special report from Rockaway Beach, where I'm going to be standing talking to the net with a handy talkie. See what's going on down here. Thank you, Mike Bravo.
So let me jump over to you right now, Barry. To my knowledge, you are in a grade A flood area, whatever they call it, grade A or station A, you know what I mean. And I know that in the far past you've had some significant water flow onto your property and around the base of your tower. Are you in an area of Far Rockaway which is the A area in which I guess Mayor Bloomberg was suggesting that it be evacuated? N2 Moonbounce, K2RAW, Grand Barry.
Okay, yeah. Actually, the mayor did suggest that this street and this area was to be evacuated. I have lived here so long, and besides that, I'm on the second floor, so I don't think I'm really in any danger. I will be moving my car, not this high tide, because this high tide is actually right now. And I'm going to go down to the ocean and take a look at it. That's what I'm going to report back to the net when I get down there. In about 10 minutes, I'm going to head out the door. And the next high tide would be tomorrow morning at about 7:45, 7:50, somewhere in there. And I'll be looking at that one. And that'll make my decision. What I'm not gonna leave. What I'm gonna do is bring my car to high ground and walk back to the house. I don't think I have to do any more than that. I do know that they have turned off the elevators in the city buildings around here. I guess they're trying to tell them something. They did want those buildings evacuated. I'm not sure why. I don't understand that. But that's what the mayor was saying on the TV tonight. But anyway, as everybody knows, I was down in the ocean a little while ago. High tide is now. I want to go down and look again. The high tide was higher than normal, but it wasn't too scary, if you know what I mean. And it's certainly not that windy yet. K2RW and 2MB, Rocky Way Beach.
I think you're on Beach 43rd Street, if I remember correctly, having visited you. I'm making a rough guess, Barry, that your property is approximately 10 feet above mean high tide. Rough guess on my part. I know you've gotten a couple of feet of water on your property from time to time. I'm guessing your house has cinder blocks for the base of it, and maybe the living quarters are a couple of feet further above earth. So I'm guessing that most of the time water does not enter your house, therefore you don't have to move your family and relatives. Are any of my guesses approximately correct, Barry, and 2MB, K2LIW?
Okay, actually, I don't think we're 10 feet above sea level. I doubt it. I think we're more like 5 feet above sea level. That's my best guess. I seriously doubt that it's 10 feet. The worst case we ever had here was like 1958 or somewhere around there. We had about a foot of water in the house downstairs, and of course it did a lot of damage. The last hurricane last year, the water never did enter the house. It was in the street, and it was enough to scare everybody because their cars were getting severely wet. It was about a foot and a half of water in the street, but it never entered the house. It had another, I guess, another 6 to 8 inches to go before it would wet the floors downstairs in this house. However, my neighbors are not so fortunate. They have had, last year, they had a foot of water in their house. It's very, very serious. It's devastating. Terrible thing. And I hope this is not going to be a reenactment of that. And I don't know, everybody thinks I'm nuts, but I kind of get the feeling that this is not going to be that bad. And some of the reasons, let me let it drop. Okay, some of the reasons are because the wind at this time is coming from the northeast towards the southwest. And that's not a bad direction for this area. The water is pushed out of the bay under those circumstances. It's not forced into it. And, of course, it's pushed away from the shoreline if it's a strong wind. So all those things are actually in our favor. Not so good if you happen to be in Long Island Sound, because then you're, you know, pushing it right into you, and the sound is open to the east, which is worse if the wind's coming from this direction. But Rockaway Beach is better off under these conditions.
KC2QIQ would have commented on that thing?
Glenn recognized. I got one more question for Barry, then I'm going to go over to Glenn. Barry, what's the tallest you've ever seen as water in the street? If, for instance, you had approximately 1 foot of water in the street, as long as you drive your automobile slowly, so you don't kick up a tremendous amount of water and flood out the engine, you could drive away as long as you're able to drive to higher land. You don't have to drive into a lower land place, if you know what I mean. If the water in the street ever gets, let me pick a number, 3 feet above street level, I'm not sure you could drive a car even slowly. And there, if you had to abandon the QTH, you'd like to have a rowboat or an inflatable craft of some kind. So me a couple of words, Barry, as to your drivability if you have to abandon the QTH. What kind of transportation would you be able to use, and where would you go? And to Moon Bounce, KQRIW.
Yeah, okay, well, I could not drive my son's car. I couldn't drive the car. My truck I could drive in a foot of water. My son's car is a small car, and I don't think you could do that. I'm not even planning on doing that, as I say. About 10 blocks from here, there's high ground. I'm leaving the car there, not tonight, because I don't think we're going to have a flood tonight. And I'll check tomorrow morning. The high tide tomorrow morning is about 7:45 or so. So at around 7 o'clock, I'll start looking to see what's happening with the tide tomorrow morning. And if it looks like it's going to be a problem, I'll drive the car half a mile to high ground, leave it there, and walk back to the house. I'm not worried about being in the house if there's a flood. I mean, it's a two-story house, so it's virtually impossible that the water's going to come up here. So I'm not even concerned about that. My neighbors are another story. I'm going to call them tonight and tell them if they run into trouble, or I'm knocking on my door. That's the best I can do for the moment.
That neighbor you have to the south, the guy who is very friendly and will allow you to attach your antennas to his property. Is his property a little bit lower than yours, or is his house lower than yours? Is that why the water can give him more grief? Barry, go ahead.
Absolutely. My house is about 2.5 feet above the street. You know, the floor, downstairs floors are about 2.5 to 3 feet above the street level, above the sidewalk. His house is actually 4 inches below the street level. You actually step down to get into his house. It's the same house as this, but this house, many, many years ago, my grandfather actually raised the second floor 3 feet higher and rebuilt the floors downstairs 3 feet up. So this house is actually higher than the one next door. The ground floor of these houses was never intended to be living quarters. It was actually a basement. This house is made of poured concrete, the first floor. It's actually poured cement. And it goes up right up to the ceiling on the downstairs. And that's the same for my neighbor's house. So it's a whole different story for me as it is for him. So that's why he's in much more serious condition there.
Is there any chance that your neighbor could put up a barrier made out of sandbags where he built a dam around the house to keep the water out up to, 2 or 3 feet's worth that he's got of sandbags, and then one little leak through, pump it out? Is that out of the question? And if he hasn't already done it, of course it's out of the question. If he hasn't already done it, it's out of the question now. But is that a possibility? Or is that something he's even considered, Barry? Go ahead.
Reason I don't think that would... First of all, nobody could do that. And the reason I don't think it would work is because below ground, there are connections... There are holes in the foundation for pipes to come through and sewer lines to come through and whatever. And I believe the water would come in those. So he would have a big problem. I don't know if anybody has ever tried that, and I don't know how successful it would be. You know, those sandbag things work to a degree, but they're not really waterproof. They leak, you know, and you have to have a pump going pretty good to keep that out. I don't think that would work. I really don't. Unless you had a very powerful pump. I don't know. I'm glad I don't have to do it, let me tell you.
And to run that pump, you need continuous power. In these flood conditions on where you live, Barry, how good is ConEd power? And have you had substantial interruptions? How about you, Barry?
Actually, I'm on the same lighting company as you. We're on Long Island Lighting, or whatever they call themselves, LIPA, whatever it is. There's a long story behind that, but this area is not on ConEd. And all the power lines are overhead. There's nothing underground. So, aside from a tree falling on a power line, we're usually pretty good. We don't lose power in storms very much. That hasn't been our problem.
I also have above ground wiring in Huntington. And during Hurricane Irene, I guess, I was out at least a day, day and a half, something in that order. And there were some people in my town that were without power for, you know, a week, 7 or so days. Let's see what Glenn's got to say about all this. And in Massapequa, where you live, Glenn, hopefully you're on high enough land that it's not a problem. KC2QIQ, KQRIW on TechNet. Give us a water story, Glenn.
I'm going to run down to the beach and check back in after Glenn. It'll be, take me about 10 minutes to get here.
And I guess we'll hear you on your handy talkie. We'll be looking forward to that. I'll go ahead, Glenn.
Hey, good evening, Dick. I think the first thing that alarmed me was what, first when I heard that what Barry was saying about the northeasterly winds right now. I just wanted to warn Barry about one quick thing here, is that we're going to see three tides, and the first two tides, you're going to see northeasterly winds, and he's absolutely correct. The tides are going to look lower than they should be because of the northeasterly winds, because the nor'easter is going to be basically taking over what we're normally seeing. So he's going to go out there tonight, and he's going to say, well, the tides look pretty good. And the second one, which will actually be like sometime earlier tomorrow, they'll be like, oh, look at that. The tides don't look bad at all. This is not going to be bad. What's actually happening here is we have a hurricane coming up in a jet stream. So the jet stream is going to pull it and tuck it in underneath. So what's going to happen is it's going to look like normally low tides on the south shore. And what will eventually happen is that the water's going to pocket in basically a matter of an hour. It's just going to, you're going to see an unload. When you let this drop for a second. The water that's building up from basically Cape Cod, Rhode Island, in the Sound is going to basically just start a current stream that's going to wind up dumping in through lower Manhattan and the Hudson, kind of like filling in the mouth pocket area between Arthur Kill, New Jersey, and the Rockaway, that area right inside there. And then the low pressure from that hurricane coming in is going to hit all at about the same time. So it's going to look like a naturally low tide is going to be an extremely high tide. Now, what they're really warning about, and why the mayor and all the governors of New Jersey and everyone is warning everybody just north of this storm to evacuate, is because you could see a breach of basically the Break Island, which hasn't happened since like 1933. There's a series, basically what happens, the tidal level goes greater than the height of, say, Fire Island, and it starts a waterfall. So while you're looking out your window in your backyard, even though you think you're south of the Sunrise Highway and you're okay, you're like, oh, look at this, there's no water here. Everything's down happening at the Bay Area. In a matter of minutes, it'll all of a sudden start rolling in like a tidal surge and roll in and basically cover everybody's foundations. And it may not be pretty, Dick. KCYW, KC2QIQ.
And something to look out for, and don't be false alarmed into a feeling of security just because the first high tide is very good looking, so to speak. The wind is going to change, what you're telling me. Your property in Massapequa is roughly how many feet above sea level, Glenn, and how far away is the Zone A to you? I think you're probably north of Sunrise Highway or north of the Montauk Highway. And I'm guessing the property south of Montauk Highway is where the Zone A is located. Is that roughly true, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW, and the TechNet?
I wish I was, Dick. I'm not in as severe of places where Barry is, but certainly maybe about 8 to 10 blocks north of the Great South Bay, south of Montauk Highway. So I'm basically less streets to Merrick Road, Montauk Highway, than I am towards the bay. But I do have canals on both sides. I have Ocean Avenue on one side of me, and I have basically Seaford Avenue on the other side, both of which are canals that run up to the Merrick Road area, Montauk Highway area. And what will happen sometimes in extreme high tides, water sometimes comes up storm drains, and you can see some water at the street level. Usually never comes on the property. But my concern this time around is that what Barry has experienced in years past in hurricanes, we may actually see this time, this far north, close to Merrick Road, and possibly further north. So I've got the go kit here, and if I've got to evacuate, I'm ready to go, Dick. And I know where I have to go, which is north of Sunrise Valley. K2IW, K2QIQ.
If water does start pouring into your street because of those canals overflowing into your street by way of the storm drains or whatever, do you have a vehicle with fairly high clearance? You have a vehicle with fairly high clearance, Glenn, so that you'd have no trouble driving through a couple of feet of water? And I presume that's your major method of taking your family and abandon the location. Is that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yes, it is, Dick. As a matter of fact, all the other vehicles have already been moved. Even as far north as I am, I've moved all the other vehicles out of here. So there's only one vehicle here inside the house right now, and it's my four-wheel drive Liberty Jeep, which has got some pretty good clearance on it. But even there again, if I start hearing that, if I see that the water starts breaching, even the canals, which are still pretty far away from my house on either side, I'm not going to wait for the water to come up. At that point, everybody's ready to go. So it's kind of like we're just seeing, is this storm going to be for real? Or is, I think there's a lot of things that have to happen for this storm to be as bad as they're saying, but I'm certainly prepared just in case. And I'll worry about it a little later. I'm not going to wait for the water to see if it's coming up the street or not. Back to you, Vic.
Radio check. Who is that with Radio Check? Go ahead with your call letters and name. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yes, this is N2XO, the OPM radio operator, and I'm used to you with the years of the year again. Nothing as far as the thing I was getting out of some important.
Okay, I think you heard that you said N2XOD, X-ray Oscar David is what it sounded like, and your signal is quite weak. We're hearing about 75% of your audio. The other 25% is dropping out. So if you're running on a handy-talky, you might have to hold it in a different location. One of the things that a lot of people forget about is that the transmitting frequency and the receiving frequency are different. So just because you move the radio into a place where you get the strongest signal on reception, it might necessarily not be the strongest signal for transmission back to the repeater. So it's a little bit marginal there, Mr. XOD. Was there another person checking in? I thought I heard another voice. K2RIW.
Sir,
NUMB,
Long Beach, and whatever your radio, give me that report.
Okay, you also got to be a little careful how you hold your handy, Barry. You are dropping out 20% of the time, and 80% of the time you're copyable. So when you find a good location, hold the handy-talky up high and hold it steady, if you know what I mean. And two moon bounds, right at the Great South Bay, K2RIW. Go ahead, Barry.
Real good. I'm ready to breathe. I hope you hear it. First off, the tide is just starting to go out. The tide is on its way out right now, so we got past high tide. It was very unusually high. The waves are quite big. There are about 10-foot waves coming in right now, which is considerable. Airplanes are still running. I can see three planes coming in for a landing into Kennedy. Now I see a fourth. So, and it's out on the water. There's like three big boats out on the water. So I guess they're not panicking. That's pretty much what I'm seeing. The tide is unusually high, though, and to my problem.
Very fine, Barry. And you were there 100% that time. You held the handy-talkie up high, shouted into it, held it steady, and carrier-wise, you're in good shape. When the wind blows every so often past your microphone, we do hear a lot of pretty loud wind noise, which is a tough one to avoid. When you watch the broadcasters at Seaside, you'll notice that they have this great big black chunk of foam around their microphone to try to limit the amount of wind noise. And as Glenn was saying, although this tide is higher than normal because of the direction the wind is blowing now, tomorrow's low tide is going to be considerably worse. something to worry about. And one of the things I've been hearing a lot when he drops is that for the people who are on the Long Island Sound, western section of Long Island Sound, like the village of Bayville, for instance, the way the water is going to be channeled into the Long Island Sound, they're probably going to see some extremely high tide by tomorrow morning. And I'm worried a little bit about my fact that I have relatives that live in the village of Bayville, pushing the Oyster Bay, and in past years, as the flooding occurs, the telephone lines that are below ground get flooded out, stop working. Those telephone lines are part of the communication system for law enforcement in that town. The town would not allow a microwave system to be installed. So the possibility is that they're going to pay a heavy price on this particular event. A very nice lady named Victoria Siegel, I think is her name, was the former mayor of the village of Bayville. And because she allowed some of the radio equipment to be installed and the town was against that, they wouldn't allow her to become the mayor anymore. And that's a sad situation from my point of view. A lot of misunderstanding there. That so-called microwave dish that they were so far against would have been a cubically beamless antenna running a couple of watts of power on top of a 180 feet of water tower aimed to the police headquarters to their north. It would have been giving no grief to the people in the town. In fact, the person could sit in front of that microwave dish 24 hours a day, 5 feet away, and it literally would be safe. So there's a lot of misunderstanding there. I'm kind of anxious to see how the village of Bayville, among other places on the western end of Long Island Sound, how they're going to fare in this particular event. Anyone with any further questions or comments on the water, rain, weather, and the whole bit that we're talking about right now, give me a call at KQLIW in the Tech Man. Okay, a little bit noisy. Sounded like KD2CMF. Sounded like Charlie Mike Foxtrot. Correct me on your call letters. Give me your name, sir, and go right ahead with your comment or question. If it's a technical question, we're going to put you on the list. You'll be number three. And if you've got a comment with reference to the weather, go right ahead. KD2CMF, question mark, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Kelly, Mike, Sierra, Roy, Romeo, Oscar, Yankee, McCarney. Sometimes I have trouble making the trip here, guys. I guess I'll check it so that I let you know I'm listening, because I think your debt to be beneficial.
Okay, you did drop out about 20% of the time, Roy, but now I think we've got your call letters. Kilo Delta 2, Charlie, Mike, Sierra. And I think you're coming in from New Jersey, and the signal is dropping in and dropping out of the voting system. But with care, we could get your message through. Okay, the first person with the question was Joe, number one, W-H-O-R-Y-Y. And lucky for you, you're not that close to the water, if I remember, or Joe. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the Tech Net.
Good evening, Dick. W-H-O-R-Y-Y. This evening. Make sure the timer resets itself here. Yeah, I'm about 2 miles actually from the water, 2.5 miles, so let's see how it's there in the next 48 hours or so. You're basically safe. My question has to do with a system that's used to amplify AM broadcast band signals from about 530 kilohertz to 1710 kilohertz. The system can put out nominally about 100 watts. It has a gain of about 50 decibels. My question is, what would be a good power meter to put on the input of this amplifying system? Make sure the final amplifier section of the system is not overdriven, because it is rather sensitive. In other words, a 3 dB increase will yield about 200 watts out. 4 dB goes up to about 250, so it's pretty easy to overdrive the amplifier, you know, without much problem at all there. What would you suggest on being that's an AM type of system in nature, and it's amplifying a bunch of signals all at once? Now, let me also tell you this. All the signals are coming out of a driver type of assembly that has some sort of AGC in it where it's not supposed to let the signals go over, say, 0 dBm, even though they're all combined, because the combined composite signal is not supposed to go over. Combined composite signal not supposed to go over 0 dBm. So what would be a good power measuring RF meter or system to be able to measure this fairly accurately, within reason, of course, taking courses in mind, that would let you do this and come out with some results that are, you know, fairly good as far as accuracy. Back to you.
Okay, Joe, I'm going to play back to you what I heard and add some comments to it. I may have heard things a little bit wrong, so you'll be correcting me, and that's okay. It's a broadband amplifier, 100 watts of output is the intended output, but I get the impression from what you said it's capable of peak envelope power of 200 or 300 watts. But let's say you're steering for the 100 watt power output level. 100 watts is plus 50 dBm. 50 decibels stronger than 1 milliwatt. And you said it's got 50 decibels of gain. So therefore, my mathematics and yours confirms that when it's putting out 100 watts of a single signal, by the calculations we just made, roughly 0 dBm, roughly 1 milliwatt is going in of a single signal. You did say that there's multiple signals that can go in there, and that represents a little bit of a problem. Let me drop and tell you what I mean. If I used a conventional power meter, and if I looked at a 1-0 dBm signal and a second 0 dBm signal I applied, the power meter, which is usually an averaging device, would see a pair of 1 milliwatt signals. It would see 2 milliwatts. However, Mother Nature always takes signals and combines them in a vector voltage manner. A pair of 0 dBm signals will give you a peak envelope power of twice voltage of any one, 6 dB increase. Therefore, two signals will give you peak envelope power of plus 6 dB, even though the average is plus 3 when you put in the two. That's for two signals. And if I go all the way to 10 signals, there would be a 20 decibel potential increase when you combine in 10 signals. As the number of signals goes up, the peak envelope power from a voltage point of view is something that goes up a lot faster than what a power meter can see. If you had a crystal detector, it would see the peak envelope power. So a calibrated crystal detector on something like a directional coupler, and maybe you need a stage of amplification after directional coupler, the crystal detector will see peak envelope power. And maybe in order to get perfect linearity out of your amplifier, you don't want the peak envelope power to go above 100 watts or maybe 200 watts, but some number like that. So in order to really see what's going on, knowing how many signals you're starting off with gives you a little bit of a hint as to how much faster the peak envelope power does go up above average. So crystal detector, fast-acting crystal detector into something like an oscilloscope would allow you to see peak envelope power and allow you to not exceed what I think is the amount of input to that amplifier that might create output distortion. That might create output distortion or intermodulation distortion. Once the output stage goes into a fraction of a decibel of limiting, because the peak envelope power is significantly above 100 watts, if 100 watts is the desired design center of power output, and you go very much above that, you're going to start getting some amount of limiting. Therefore, the multiple signals will be mixed to each other. And if, for instance, the two input signals were separated by half a megacycle, there'd be a new signal generated by the final stage, a half megacycle above the highest and a half megacycle below the lowest. And those are intermodulation distortion products. And when it comes to FCC standards, that may be a problem. So that gives you some of my first thoughts on this one, Joe. Interesting problem for the A2LYY in the AM broadcast world. A2LYW of the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, but as they also said, I haven't seen the driver's circuit or a system that feeds this this amplifier system, but that is supposed to be controlling or have the power output all combined and controlled to a point where you can adjust that power up or down. And I know that we're playing with AM here, and I know the signals can actually vary a little bit up and down, you know, a couple of decibels, and you're talking about, you know, a lot of combined energy. But, you know, the thing itself is supposed to be able to keep the thing at a certain set point once you set the output to drive the amplifier. So I'm looking for something that's relatively easy to use, fairly reasonably accurate, that's going to be able to tell you, okay, I'm putting in, you know, 0 dBm to this point that's feeding your, you know, power amplifier. I'm putting in -3 or +3 or whatever. I try to do this with an oscilloscope or a spectrum analyzer. The people involved doing this are not really going to be able to be that clever about it. They have to know what they're looking at. So something that you can suggest that would be simple to use, easy to use, but be fairly accurate, would be going in the right direction.
I think I see where you're going here, Joe. The Cadillac approach would be a crystal detector, maybe amplification in front of it, after the sampling device, which maybe is a directional coupler, or maybe just a simple T connector. In some cases, you can get away with that. So a crystal detector does see instantaneous voltages, including those peaks. And with an oscilloscope, you'd now be able to really look at the peaks in the time domain and the voltage domain, and it tells you a kind of real good truth. But because they don't want to dedicate an oscilloscope to this operation, and the day will come, by the way, when a solid-state flat-screen oscilloscope will look like an iPhone number 4, if you know what I mean. The day is coming very soon in which an iPhone 4-like device will give you a beautiful oscilloscope display and not be very many dollars, but we're not there yet. The next best thing I could recommend, Joe, which wouldn't be very expensive, although it's going to take you a little bit of engineering time, is a so-called peak and hold circuit. There's a kind of diode rectifier with an operational amplifier feedback network which will hold peak voltages for some period of time, and it looks for instantaneous peak, charges to that peak, and holds it. And the discharge time, you could make it to many seconds, and the charge time, a fraction of a millisecond. So a operational amplifier, and there are op amps you can buy in the shop. There are op amps you could buy from DigiKey and in the old days, the bubble packs at Radio Shack that cost a fraction of a dollar, that have more than enough gain and frequency response, and can run on one single power supply with the right kind of a circuit. So a crystal detector peak hold circuit, peak and hold, where you could make the charge time very fast, the discharge time very slow, and that in turn goes into whatever kind of a display you like. It could be a galvanometer, a Dawson valve movement, it could be a barber pole display, or it could be just a red light that lights up coming out of the output of that peak hold circuit of that op amp. So that kind of a circuit in production could be done for $2, if you know what I mean, once the engineering is done. So you do want a voltage detecting circuit, you want to look at the peak voltage, and so that's the approach I would take if they're not willing to take the Cadillac approach. You're going to use the Cadillac approach on the first prototype, but when it comes to the production run, that kind of an op-amp circuit could do it very well. There's lots of books on op-amps, and there's lots of websites on operational amplifiers that will help you on this one, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, H-U-R-I-W on the tech pad.
Okay, I think you're still missing the whole thing here. This wasn't something I was looking to build or engineer from start. I'm looking for advice on going in the direction of buying something commercially made that's already put together and that works reasonably well. That's the direction I'd like to go into. I can't get into building this thing or trying to re-engineer something or trying to calibrate or whatever, because I have no real way of doing that. I'm looking for something that's already built, already calibrated, and already works.
Yeah, now I give you a 50-50 chance of being able to find what you want. A circuit that is a peak hold circuit running at the fraction of a volt level. That's what you're going to get, because you're talking about around 0 dBm. 0 dBm, I think, is a quarter of a volt, 0.27 volts, something in that order, on a 50-ohm line. So we're talking about a fraction of a volt peak hold circuit, and you'd like to buy that off-the-shelf, ready to go. And because the number of people requiring that is so darn small, is there a off-the-shelf item? That's going to take some research. And as I said, I give you a 50-50 chance you'll be able to find one. If you can't find one, it's not going to take you very much time to build one, but I know that you don't want to invest that time. That's about the best I can suggest, Joe. A B2RYY, B2RYW in the TechNet.
So, we're thinking along the same lines here. Something that has a device that's capable of measuring RF power at a low level, let's say like minus, with a range of say minus 30 to plus 20, with a thermistor type of head, that wouldn't be practical for this type of thing, because you talked about power that's going to be measured fairly quickly, and I guess those things are type of more of an averaging type of instrument, correct?
That's correct, Joe. Something with a thermistor tends to be very close to a true RMS power meter. And that's not what you want. In your particular case, just measuring the average power of all of the signals gives you a piece of information that, with a whole lot of other intelligence, if you know that there are four signals present, and that the four signals are approximately the same peak amplitude, but because they're all being amplitude modulated, that represents a problem. How many of them are going to hit the peak of modulation simultaneous with the peak of the RF phase angle of the carrier, if you know what I mean? So even with that intelligence, any kind of a RMS average meter like thermistor is going to give you an answer that's in the ballpark, but it's going to give you a lot of misdetections of the events you might want to know about that exceed the peak envelope power. You really want a RF crystal detecting circuit with a very fast attack time that can really measure the instantaneous peaks that are a function of the amplitude modulation as well as the phase coherence. Every so often, signal number one and signal number two are going to hit 0 degrees of phase difference of carrier at the exact same instant. They both hit the peak of amplitude modulation of the music they're playing. And so your crest factor in this environment can be extremely high compared to average. Crest-to-average ratio is what I'm worried about. Therefore, to really get the right answer, you want voltage crystal detecting, fast attack time, sampling circuit, sample and hold circuit, then into whatever kind of a display you like, which could be, as I said, green and red lights, or a barber pole, or real Dawson Bowl movement. So just thermistor and averaging power, I don't think is enough, unless you've got a lot of extra headroom in that amplifier. If the amplifier is capable of doing a clean job of... If the amplifier is giving you a clean output signal of, let me pick a number, 500 watts peak envelope power with a low duty factor, when it's running an average of 100 watts, if you've got that extra headroom, then maybe you can get by with a thermistor. But if you don't have that huge headroom, if that amplifier is not being backed off a whole lot of dB, then as I see it, you need the truthful answer of a crystal detector, sample and hold, and a peak detector circuit that operates very fast on the attack time and very slow on the discharge time. W2RYY, T2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, Dick, without going into specifics about the type of equipment it is, because it is basically, I guess you call it commercial, but it's more that, from that type of atmosphere. Say with 0 dBm going in, an increase of 3 dB, it's still about a CW carrier, by the way, with no modulation on it, in the center of the frequency range. So I'm just looking at one signal frequency at each time. An input gain of 3 dB gives you from 100 watts to 200 watts, and it seems to follow that pretty true. Going up one more dB seems to be about 250 watts, which seems to make sense. Now, going down in a negative way, a drop of 10 dB is not quite a drop of 10 dB on the output. It drops a little more than 10 dB. I should say the first 10 dB drop, it seems to be fairly linear. It seems to work pretty good like that. But as you approach them, say a signal minus 20 dBm, the input is not quite down 20, it's actually like down 21 or 21.5 decibels. So it's not exactly linear going to a negative, going down negative. By the time you get down to say 50 dBm, the signal coming out is about like minus 1.6, 1.7. So it loses some of its linearity of what you want to call it, going back in a negative direction. But I'm not really sure if that's really the most important thing to think about here. But maybe it is. But anyway, the thing is, the whole device in itself is not really tolerable. It has no high power protection if it overloads. It just has a sensor that sends in parts of it that are making the RF power draw too much current. And it'll try to shut itself down, but it has no RF protection as far as if it saw like a mismatch or a little bit more gain on one end of the band, the other end, it can't control that. It's just sort of a brute force type of amplifier, wide band of nature. Back to you.
Yeah, let me ask you this question, Joe. If you and I were setting up a wireless cable TV system, in, let me say, a rural area of Pennsylvania. In other words, in the valley that you and I care about in Pennsylvania, there's very poor AM radio reception. And on the nearby mountain, you and I set up a receiving site that picks up a 4 or 5 nearby AM radio signals, amplifies them, and retransmits them down into that valley. If that's the kind of an amplifier that you and I are talking about, that kind of a situation, the problem that would happen is that the radio propagation day and night and the ionospheric state and the gray zone, where is the sun and whatever, and where's the D-layer absorption, all kinds of variables take place so that the individual signal in that environment I just described would make them go up and down quite a bit from day to day and hour to hour, and therefore the right kind of a servo mechanism on this thing. I can really see peak envelope power and readjust things accordingly. And maybe you'd really like to have an equalizing network. Let me stop. You'd really like to have, in the ideal world, an equalizing network that looks at the individual signals of the individual AM stations from their particular locations and adjust that portion of the gain of the system so that each of them comes through with the right amplitude back into our valley in Pennsylvania, if you know what I mean. So if you try to do a live broadcast signal input into a variable environment like I just described, then all this this protection network you and I are slowly describing in our head would be required. If, however, the signals have already been properly leveled before they're being applied to this amplifier, then life becomes a lot simpler. How much variable must you live with here? WHYY, KQRIW in the dead man.
Well, Dick, I don't know much about the driver circuit. I was just asked that particular question, and I did ask exactly what you asked about how much the signal varies day to night. There's like a range of like 15 or 17 signals that are coming into this system. It's not amplify the entire band. And what the frequency range is, of course, is from the entire U.S. broadcast band. It's supposed to be careful about doing that. But all I was told is that the output that drives this high power in the system is supposed to be adjustable to a certain point where you can set the power to a point and it should hold it there with some sort of ATC type of action taking place. Because apparently, like I said, again, this amplifier system is not too tolerable to overload. In other words, if something came in all of a sudden with 6 dB stronger than it was set for, the amplifier is not capable of producing that kind of energy going out, and it would definitely overload it. If it kept on doing it, it would probably cause a problem in part of it. It uses an amplifying system which actually has 4 separate RF modules inside the box itself. They're being combined into a combiner to get your 100 watts out. So each module is doing a lot of work within itself, being that it is, I would imagine probably Class A in its basic operation internally. So each module is doing quite a bit of work, and you're losing quite a bit of RF across this internal combining device inside. To the fact that I measured, I think it's about 6.5 dB per port from input to output. There's not much drop. So each module is working pretty hard. So then again, that's also the reason why I don't want to overdrive the thing too much, because it wouldn't take much to put it out of commission. That's why I'm asking all these kind of questions. I have been checking stuff on the website that may power me, but I figured I'd ask you because you have probably a pretty good understanding of what I'm trying to gain by getting the right type of meter to do the right job in the first place.
On that last transmission, Joe, you said some magic words. You said 16 or 17 signals, to which I said, wow. Let me just round off what happens with 16 signals. If the 16 signals were approximately the same amplitude by some magic coming into your system, compared to any one signal, when you put 16 signals together, the average power goes up 12 dB. That's understandable. However, the peak envelope power of 16 signals as voltage combining is a 24 decibel increase, 24.1. So in other words, if you had only one signal going in and you looked at the peak envelope power of that one signal pouring through your amplifying system, and then you apply the other 15 signals, although the probability of carrier-wise them all hitting peak envelope power, hitting 0 degrees of phase at the same time, is a low probability, but with that low probability, occasionally you're asking the amplifier to give you 24 decibels more peak envelope power output than one single signal when there's 16 of them there. Periodically, that's going to happen. If they were steady-state signals, now you make those signals, each one of them, around 0 dBm of average power. Let me drop. But each one of them is amplitude modulated, which means the peak envelope power during modulation goes up 4 to 1. A 0 dBm signal will hit plus 6 dBm on the positive peaks of the amplitude modulation and minus infinity. You know, the carrier pinches off, but the carrier goes to double voltage, 6 dB higher during amplitude modulation. If you hit 100% amplitude modulation, you get 16 individual signals all going up and down with their amplitude modulation. Wow. Properly setting all of those 16 signals to have enough power going to the amplifier that the amplifier is really being used, yet not so darn weak that the noise of the amplifier starts dominating and the noise of the rest of the system starts dominating, and yet the peak envelope power of amplitude modulation and phase coherence that's going to happen periodically, for that not to hit the ceiling of the amplifier and either do damage or make intermodulation distortion that splatters all over the band, it is a difficult requirement. 16 simultaneous signals is tough. Therefore, this detecting network that you and I are discussing right here now, so really has to be fast-acting diode rectification, sample and hold circuit. In other words, a fast attack, slow decay, to find out what is the real instantaneous peak right now. And so during the time that somebody is playing the Robert Souser march, you know, the Stars and Stripes Forever, some really loud music on one or two of those channels, during that period of time, the system gain would have to be cut back so as not to be splattering all over the place. Oh, you joke, to K2LYY. You see what I'm worried about here? K2LYW in the tech net.
I know it's a complicated question, and I do understand that. As I said, I haven't seen the workings of the driver circuitry that's taking all these signals off the air and supposed to keep them combined to a level of no greater than 0 dBm. I haven't seen that circuit, so I don't know much about that, but apparently it sounds like it's just more than a simple, complicated thing. It's more complicated than just making a simple measurement. And probably it's probably what was done in the back, the title was done in the past, what was done in the past, some people just simply put a walkie on the output of the thing, and they try to tune it, so to speak, so the output is about 100 watts, what they say a walkie here. But I know that's not really the right way to do it either. You don't know how much you're overdriving thing or how much it's capable of doing at an instant in time because the watt meter can't pop to keep up with an instantaneous change of signal. It can't display something that quickly. So I guess it's a little bit of a complicated question for the tech in general. Back to you.
Yeah, one other thing to worry about here, Joe, is that the lowest frequency is around 500 kilohertz. The highest frequency is 1.7 megacycle. That's approximately one megacycle of separation in frequency between the highest and the lowest signal. Therefore, to really catch the instantaneous peak of just those two signals walking through the amplifier, you really want a tap time of your crystal diode detecting network to be well under 1 microsecond. So you're looking for an attack time of under a microsecond, a hold time of maybe a second or two, in order to really find out what's going on as far as whether or not your amplifier is being overloaded. To simply put a power meter on the output of an amplifier where 16 individual signals of various amplitudes and various amplitude modulation are going through it, that power meter is going to be dancing all over the place, and how you interpret it. I mean, to set that to an average power of 100 watts, that gets you into the parking lot. It maybe doesn't get you into the ballpark unless you've got a lot of extra smarts, unless the amplifier has a lot of extra headroom. You could be creating quite a bit of splatter. And this particular environment, from your point of view, Joe, is there a heavy FCC requirement as to all of the undesired products coming out of this amplifier? In many situations in the broadcast world, I think they want all undesired products to be something like 80 decibels suppressed from any one carrier. It's a pretty tough requirement. KCA, W8-2-L-Y-1, K2-L-A-W in the tech minute.
Yes, I've thought about all this, and I do understand this. So it's more of a complicated situation than just simply asking a question. Okay, somebody makes this type of device to do that. It seems like this is where this thing is going. All right. Thank you for your time. Back to you, and probably go to the next guy. Will be in line here.
And to a... Okay, you've got an interesting problem there, Joe, and as you work on it and you start coming up with a solution, good or bad, please report back to us and let us know what you hear, what you say, what you hear, what you find. I think I heard N2MB. Is that true, Barry? Are you back with another report? N2MB, K2LAW?
It was more like N2MH, Mike Hotel.
N2 Mike Hotel. That'll be your name, sir, and your comment on this subject, or do you want to be added to the list, in which case you've the two guys, one or two guys ahead of you. N2 Mike Hotel. That'll be your name, K2LAW. My name is Dick.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. My name is Mark, M-A-R-K, and we're in West Orange, New Jersey, on a UHF repeater out here. And we've never chatted before, but your reputation precedes you in your white papers to the savvy amateur radio operator. And I think you know where those are. Anyhow, I do have a comment on the driver equipment for this amplifier that Joe's working on. Joe and I happen to work in the same shop together. And I have worked on the head-end equipment for this. And if you want a little quick rundown, I can give it to you.
I sure do, Mark. And I bet your N2MH is a call letter that matches your... A diamond call that matches your name. Sure enough, it does. Very nice. Go ahead, Mr. Harrison. Give us some more information. It's a fascinating problem. N2 Mike Hotel, K2LAW.
Okay, Jake, very fine. Well, this call sign precedes the vanity call system, but it is my initials, and since it precedes it, I don't have to pay for it, so that's real nice. Anyhow, there is head-end equipment on this, a individual channel card for each AM station that is to be received off the air, Like Joe said, there's something like 17 or 20 stations that lost count. Basically, it's every station in the New York City area. And I leave that as an exercise for you to figure out what the number really is. Each channel card does have AGC on it, and our individual adjustments on each channel card for output level that goes into a combiner circuit. And the combiner circuit, the output of that is an aggregate which feeds this broadband amplifier. And that, in a nutshell, is what's going on. There's other stuff that's going on there, but it's not germane to this issue.
Okay, Hank, my question, Mark. Mark, what you just gave us helps an awful lot. If the individual channels of the individual broadcast stations are individually going through a circuit that has automatic gain control, so therefore you know the specific amplitude by way of that servo system of each of the individual 16 or 20 signals, now you're way ahead of the game. In that case, where you've got that much control of individual amplitudes before they're being combined, you therefore can predict ahead of time, with high probability, what will really be the instantaneous peak envelope power with what particular probability. In other words, because you've got so darn many signals, you're really running into what I call the central limit theorem. You're running into a crest factor that is huge, but it's a kind of a Gaussian curve where the probability of that crest factor is so low that by the normal mechanisms by which the FCC measures what we're looking for now, intermodulation distortion, they're using something like a Stoddard meter, which has some form of averaging function when it comes to looking for the individual intermodulation distortion products. So as such, you've now got a lot of extra intelligence on the job. As such, knowing the real characteristics of your amplifier, knowing the real characteristics of your individual signals, and your individual signals are being automatic gain controlled, therefore you've got a beautiful mathematical problem. You give that to the right kind of a RF savvy mathematician, he can tell you exactly what level you should set the individual signals for going into that amplifier. Therefore, he can predict exactly how much intermod distortion with what probability. In other words, you now have a clearly defined instantaneous crest factor of that system. Do you see where I'm going on this one, Mark? So it sounds to me like it's a lot more defined than first my first impression. M2 Mike Hotel, K2LAW in the Tech Man.
K2RIW and the TechMac N2MH. Yeah, it is very well defined. There is another glitch in here, but let's just leave it at this for now. This is a very good discussion. And yes, I was thinking in terms of probability with the number of stations here and their modulation products. So it's be very hard to get everything to peak all at the same time. So therefore, you're into some sort of averaging or probability arena. And I don't know any other way to do it except to say, okay, for the individual input levels, each carrier will be adjusted for the same level going into this amplifier. And assuming that each carrier will be somewhere modulated 100% by the station, I would take the single tone output power divided by the number of stations, add in another 50% perhaps for the total modulation power, and say, okay, whatever that works out to be, 3 watts or so is what each carrier should be doing, coming out of the amplifier, subtract 50 dB from that, and that should be your input.
That gets you into the ballpark. For proof of concept, I do recommend you take the real signals, put them through the system, and plug the whole thing into a real good spectrum analyzer and look for all the undesired products and really measure them. I recommend you do that because this is one of those situations where even a medium smart mathematician could make quite a few decibels of error. Assuming now that you've got to meet some FCC broadcast standard requirements for this particular system, I do recommend that on the first product you produce, that you do that careful spectrum analyzer confirmation, proof of concept confirmation. After that, I think you've got it made. In other words, once you know the nature of those signals and the nature of your AGC on your individual channels, after that, you've got it made. So I do recommend that confirmation be done at least once. You see where I'm going in this one, Mark? Because, yes, you're absolutely right. The chances of 16 individual signals hitting absolute peak phase, 0 degrees of phase between them simultaneously, it's probably an event that occurs once per 10 minutes, and it occurs for 1 microsecond at that particular instantaneous peak. Yes, the system is going to be, by definition, saturated, but it's such an extremely low probability that the total amount of averaged intermodulation distortion product could very well